Welcome to Signs of Life, Exploring Survival of Consciousness, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation on the web at www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I can feel you like an ocean that won't seem to let me go.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to Signs of Life with our host, Bob Ginsberg. I blew that one, huh? With our host, Bob Ginsberg, I'm Fran Ginsberg, and our show tonight is sponsored by HCH, an institute for psycho-spiritual trainings, and can be found on the web at www.hypotherapytraining.com. Tonight's guest is Dr. Stephen E. Browdy, and if you have a question, comment, or would like to talk to our guest, the toll-free number here is 888-815-9756, or you can instant message the studio at Signs of Life Radio on AIM. And good evening to you, Bob.
Hello, Fran.
I thought you were going to say my last name, which is the same as your last name, and then you could screw it up and apologize to our listeners.
We get a lot of... I just wanted to mention, you know, we get a lot of inquiries, and sometimes people wonder how we pick our guests and why we interview people from so many, you know, diverse backgrounds. Like somebody might say, well, what does, energy healing have to do with the afterlife, you know, or what does telepathy, you know, have to do with an afterlife? And the answer to that is I think we have to learn as much as we can about all the different phenomena, because it's very conceivable that there's a common thread. You know, I was reading last night in Dr. Swanson's book about life force, and he theorizes that there are different bodies that we have. We have our physical, you know, body, but we have an etheric body, an astral body, you know, a mental body, and our, you know, we have this energy life force that runs through us through like an acupuncture system with different meridians and chakras, and that this energy has its own frequency. You know, people call this energy by various names. You know, the ancients were aware of it, you know, chi and prana and things like that. But the theory that Dr. Swanson proposes is that this frequency that we have, and this energy force, matches and gives us access to all these other realms, the etheric realm, you know, the astral realm, and so forth, by, you know, methods that we're not aware of, you know. So, you know, everybody's frequency is different, and just as it can give us access to... let's say an etheric or an astral realm, it's the realm of the afterlife has its own frequency, you know. And maybe that explains why, you know, people aren't always able to communicate.
Well, you're saying because they would be in these different realms?
Because it's not a synchronization of frequencies. You know, maybe the frequency of somebody, a discarnate, in the realm of the afterlife, for lack of a better term, is not a match, so to speak, with the life force that runs through your particular body. It's just the way it is, you know. So now the question remains, you know, can we change our frequency? I don't know the answer to that.
Mediums say we can.
Yeah.
Mediums say, you know, they raise their frequency and they teach mediumship courses where they're hopefully teaching people how to raise their frequency, not just telling them, oh, well, go ahead and raise your frequency. And then people go to these development courses, and eventually they're able to turn it on and open up and reach those frequencies that you're now calling, reach those areas that you're now calling frequencies.
Right. And, you know, it may be other methods through meditation. through other various disciplines of really quieting the mind and changing the physiology of your body. So, you know, a lot of these things that we think have nothing to do with our body may have a lot to do with our body, you know, if you think in terms of a resonant frequency that goes on. So, you know, mediums do say, I used to hear that a lot too, that, well, that's how I communicate, a medium, and so, you know, I raise my frequency, and I never could quite grasp that, you know, how do you do that? But I guess science today would have a term for that, you know, biofeedback, you know, so... when you talk about biofeedback, it's more in the realm of mainstream science, you know, rather than medium talk. But I think they're talking about the same thing.
Well, biofeedback wasn't a part of mainstream science 30 years ago.
Right.
So,
or you know, biofield research, you know, is another term that you
hear. Right. And I think as we go ahead and we talk about it, other people talk about it, people share their experiences, I think more and more of these things that get thrown into that basket of paranormal make their way across the line into accepted mainstream science.
Right. And, you know, when we talk about, you know, an afterlife, you know, what mediums do, you know, to me, you know, seems like, you know, it's just another form of telepathy. You know, just, you know, the people that they're communicating with happen not to have a body, you know, but nonetheless they're entities of consciousness and they're communicating via telepathy. So it's important for us to study telepathy from physical embodied people to learn about more about how it might take place with disembodied people.
So you're saying when the average person has an experience, let's say that their grandmother dies, and before they even find out, the grandmother appears before them in their bedroom, is that, we call that an afterlife encounter or an after-death communication, although the person in this case doesn't even know it's an after-death communication. They don't know that the grandmother has yet died. They think she's in the bedroom. How do we explain that in today's science?
Well, you know, you know, Dr. Swanson would explain it by saying we have this etheric body that surrounds our physical body and is very, very close to it, you know, if you want to talk in terms of distance. And when we see an apparition or a ghost, what we're really seeing is that physical person, after they die, they're shedding the physical body, but we're seeing the etheric body that still remains for a period of time. Of course, it's only conjecture, you know, how long, you know, that stays. Does it stay for... And, you know, in terms of time, the physical time, you know, weeks, months, years, centuries.
Well,
you know?
Yeah, I mean, you have to ask these questions, and you have to start gathering all the stories and analyzing them too. Because I do recall, and I think we have it up on our MySpace. It's either Laura Lynn Jackson, the medium, or Lynn LeClaire, the medium, that tells the story about when they were a little kid and they knew their grandmother was going to die because they had seen her, and they even described to their mother at the time, because they were, whichever one of it was a small child, maybe 8 years old, described to the mother, oh, grandma died, and the mother said, oh, no, don't ever say anything. Oh, that's a terrible thing to say. And then, of course, the grandmother died the next day or that night or something and was wearing exactly the same outfit that the medium had seen her grandmother wearing.
Right.
So this ethereal body, is it able to conjure up outfits, or are there remnants of the way they dressed when they were here in the physical world? That, to me, is, like, so interesting that they're able to portray themselves, even when they come through the mediums, when any spirit comes through, they're able to portray themselves in particular clothing if they have to be.
Yeah, well, it's a great question. Who knows, you know, because in the mental realm, supposedly, you know, we manifest these things by thought, but is this an etheric body, is that something that's an entity of thought, or is that just a remnant, you know, is that, we think in terms of, is it a conscious entity? I don't know the answer to that, but someday I'll find out.
Soon, I hope.
Really? Did you mean that the way it sounded?
Oh, I know, but that's fine too.
I meant after I shed the physical body.
Oh, for you.
It means I die.
No, you can hang around. I'm ready to go.
Okay.
I've had enough. All right. Anyway, I think we're ready to go to our break. And when we come back, we're going to hear more about these kinds of things and the unseen world from our guest, Dr. Stephen Browdy. So stay tuned.
Heal your loss and grief through these spiritual hypnotherapy CDs. Titles include Talking with the Dead, The Inner Healer, Meeting Your Higher Self, and A Past Life Regression and Between Life Exploration. Dr. Holly Holmes Meredith is Director of HCH Institute for Hypnotherapy and Psychospiritual Trainings. Go to hypnotherapytraining.com to sample and order her CDs. These CDs will empower you in your healing and transformation.
For years, people have been reporting communication from those no longer in our physical world. Historically, science and religion have taught us to ignore such messages. Yet, there is now substantial scientific evidence to the contrary. In response to this, the Forever Family Foundation has developed a sign registry to demonstrate the existence of this other dimension. On our website, people can register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to a specific loved one. Upon the registrant's passing, the stored information can be verified by the recipient of these signs. Participants will be taking part not only in a grand scientific experiment, but in providing the greatest gift of all, the knowledge that we survive our physical death. For more information, contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707, or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Or to register a sign, go directly to thesignregistry.com.
The American Association of Electronic Voice Phenomena has always been international and concerned with more than just EVP. To better serve the public, the AAEVP is now Association Transcommunication, or ATRANSC. Their new website is ATRANSC.org, and their motto is Objective Evidence of Survival. The directors believe people should know that death is not dying, and what we learn now applies to what we will learn hereafter.
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide a forum where individuals and families who have suffered the loss of a loved one can turn for support, information, and hope. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. The Forever Family Foundation is a joint effort of scientists, research mediums, and interested people who support the premise that life does not end with physical death. We wish to prove that the bond of the family cannot be broken even by death. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707. That's 631-425-7707. Or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
And welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation. The number here is 1-888-815-9756. And tonight's guest is Dr. Stephen Browdy. Dr. Browdy is a professor of philosophy and chair of the department at the University of Maryland. He is editor-in-chief of the Journal of Scientific Exploration. Professor Browdy is past president of the Parapsychological Association. He's the recipient of several grants and fellowships. He's published more than 60 philosophical essays in professional journals, and he's the author of 5 books. His most recent book is The Gold Leaf Lady and Other Parapsychological Investigations. That book describes Professor Browdy's own encounters with the paranormal. And besides being a philosopher, a parapsychologist, an author, a lecturer, Dr. Browdy is also a professional pianist and composer, and a prize-winning stereo photographer. I guess that's enough, and welcome.
Thank you very much. It's good to be on the show again.
And it's great, always great to have you. You know, I just mentioned that you're a stereo photographer, and I'm not so sure. I think I read about stereo photography in terms of investigation, you know, into auras and orbs. Is that what we're talking about here?
Well, it's been used in psychical research for a long time. Stereo photography, or 3D photography, was actually invented in the late 19th century, and it was used in quite a few of the early investigations of physical mediums. The idea was that if you could see the phenomena in three dimensions, then you'd have a better sense of what was actually going on in the environment.
Mm. You know, you spent certainly a good part of your academic career researching phenomena that many of your colleagues would categorically dismiss, you know, and I always wonder, what was it that kept you so focused despite working in such a so-called uncomfortable environment?
Clearly, I'm stupid. I don't know.
I know that's not the case, so.
I'm just a glutton for punishment, I suppose.
Oh, okay.
I have to live with myself, basically, and I knew that some remarkable things had happened in my life, and I needed to confront them and work it out for myself. And the more I got into it and realized how much of the academic resistance I was encountering was really the result of ignorance and prejudice and cowardice, the easier it became, frankly, because I realized that the people who were opposing me most strenuously really didn't know what they were talking about. They were just posturing and bluffing.
Mm. And you really enjoy you know, a stellar reputation, you know, among your colleagues in the parapsychological world, because, I mean, everything that you write, all your essays and your books present both sides of the argument, you know, very well. I mean, and so many people, you only read about one side. I mean, I've learned a lot by reading your work, because you propose alternative explanations that I quite frankly never thought of.
Well, that's very gratifying to hear. Thank you very much. I mean, that's part of my philosophical training. It's part of the standards that I personally subscribe to. I mean, I think it's important to approach these matters with as much open-mindedness as possible and with as clear a head as possible, and to try to weigh the options as clearly as possible.
Mm. Well, why is it that so many people are so averse to discussion of evidence that we can affect things with our minds? You know, instead of, I would think that they would be fascinated, but so many people look upon it as a threat. You know, you hear things like, you know, I was scared, or I got goosebumps, or, you know, why is that?
Well, I do have my own view about that, and part of it is that, think of it this way, if I could move, let's say, a cigarette a millimeter by thought alone, it's a very small step conceptually from being able to do that to making somebody drop dead by thought alone. So the existence of any psychokinesis at all is very threatening, because it forces us to take seriously a kind of magical worldview that most of us associate, usually condescendingly, only with so-called primitive cultures. It's a worldview where thoughts can kill or have other sorts of malevolent consequences, where you might have to worry about things like the evil eye and hexing. And although there are parts of the world, obviously, where people take those beliefs as a matter of course, it doesn't go down very well in most industrialized cultures.
Mm. Well, and also, I think it must have something to do with the fact that a lot of people find some comfort, you know, in throwing up their hands and saying, well, we're not in control. You know, what's going to happen is going to happen. But some of this phenomena shows that we may very well play an active role in what happens to us.
Yes, and I think that's very scary for a lot of people, because it raises the specter of unconscious harm to others. I mean, you know, in parts of the world where people put hexes on other folks, they don't worry particularly about that. But I think few people in industrialized cultures are comfortable with the idea that if you have a nasty thought about persons, and most of us do at some time or another, and then that person has some misfortune or an accident or whatever, few of us, I think, are very comfortable with the idea that we might have played some role in that misfortune. But if we take this idea seriously, then we might have to take responsibility for a range of things that most of us would just as soon be bystanders for.
Mm. And a lot of your peers in the scientific community would have to rethink, 30 years of education, right?
Well, I think another, I'm glad you mentioned that, because another reason I think some of this seems so intimidating is the fact that if psychokinesis or psychic functioning of any kind exists, it isn't, presumably it doesn't just happen for parapsychologists and when parapsychologists set out to look for it. It could have been muddying the waters in conventional science for hundreds and hundreds or thousands of years. So, you know, if a scientist's motivation could be one of the things that triggers, say, unconscious influence on equipment or experimental results, that could have been influencing centuries of scientific discovery.
Right. I mean, when people talk about the experimenter effect, and
right.
So many of these studies seem to be influenced by the attitude and beliefs of the experimenter. There's quite a history of well-credentialed scientists and academics who have intensely observed, you know, materializations and seances and physical mediumship, and you don't see much of that today due to the scarcity of physical mediums, at least in this country. But I know you were recently invited to attend as an observer a group of where there was some physical mediumship taking place, and that was the Felix group in Germany, I believe. So,
that's right.
I mean, a lot of that, I know that from what my readings and a lot of physical mediumship, many people talk about ectoplasm, and I would imagine many of our listeners are unfamiliar with that term. So could you just give me a brief explanation about what ectoplasm is purported to be?
Well, it's a general term describing the stuff that seems to emerge on or sometimes from a physical medium's body. And the material itself can be of various kinds of things. Sometimes in the history of the field, it seems almost to be something like paper. At other times, cloth-like. And other times, something a little more gooey and organic and wet. So it actually takes a variety of forms. And sometimes the forms are kind of amorphous. Sometimes they resemble parts of human beings. Sometimes in full figure or full form materializations, they seem to evolve into an actual human, full human figure.
I remember a number of years back, Fran and I going to one of the museums in Manhattan, and they had an exhibition of physical mediumship and ectoplasm. And I remember looking at some of the photographs, and they seemed...
This was the Metropolitan, yes.
Metropolitan. I mean, some of them seemed to so overtly fake that, you know, you just had a laugh. But others, you know, seemed legitimate. So I guess there was quite a bit of trickery and fakery in the Victorian age of mediumship. And I would imagine there's sort of a combination of both.
Well, of course. I mean, and it's one of the reasons mediumship of various kinds got a bad rap, whether it was physical mediumship or mental mediumship. But, you know, the irony is some of the material that looked very suspicious may not have been. I mean, I think it would have required incredible stupidity on the part of some of these mediums to intentionally come up with a kind of materialization that looked so flagrantly contrived. I mean, if they wanted to bring suspicion on themselves, nothing would have been as effective as that. So why would they have done it? I don't think that the mediums were that stupid. I think in principle, the material could take any form whatsoever, and what form it takes might really tell us something about the deep psychology of the medium, not about whether it's fraudulent. I mean, who knows what form it's going to take? You know, the case I investigated of the gold leaf lady, here's a woman whose body broke out in what looks like golden foil. And when you actually start digging into her life, I think it becomes clear what was going on and why the material took that particular form. But otherwise, it seems very odd and, to some, I'm sure, very suspicious.
Well, and you're referring to, the book, your most recent book, The Gold Leaf Lady, and other parapsychological investigations. So I would imagine that when you had some disbelief when you first came upon this person who seemed to be who was, you know, exuding this gold-like material out of her pores. I mean, I guess that made you intensely, you intensely wanted to study this further.
Well, yeah, I was certainly on guard. I would correct just one thing. It wasn't clear that it was coming out of her pores because it appeared instantaneously on her. And really, in the blink of an eye. And
yeah.
Although I never saw this, I saw photos and other evidence suggesting that it sometimes appeared apart from her body. So it looked like it was either something she was just materializing out of nothing, or it was an apport, something that she was transferring from one location onto herself.
Mm. And I might mention to our listeners that Dr. Browdy has several websites, but an interesting one is jazzphilosopher.com, just the way it sounds, jazzphilosopher.com, and you could read more about the Gold Leaf Lady and his other books on that website. So when you were at the this seance, I mean, how many people were in attendance? You know, it was is it a large gathering, a small number of people? Dr. Browdy? We seem to have lost connection, and I guess we'll have Dr. Browdy back in a little bit. I for those who haven't had the opportunity to read that book, it is kind of fascinating because not only is Dr. Browdy was talking about this woman, it seemed to be like a gold leaf, that thin foil-like material, and it would just appear on this woman in all, you know, various body parts, and there were so many different possible explanations.
I'm back.
Glad to have you back. So,
thank you. Good to be back. I don't know what happened. Maybe somebody listening in was zapping the connection.
I guess maybe
they were trying to zap you to another location.
It wasn't the Gold Leaf Lady that was doing that, but the. So what I was asking before was the number of people that were in attendance at the session that you attended. Was it one session or a series of sessions? Or
you mean in Germany?
Germany, yeah.
There were two kinds of sessions. The group began in 2005, and originally it was focused on table tilting kinds of experiments, and as that went on, one of the participants through meditation and self hypnosis. Discovered he apparently had some mediumistic abilities, which he started to develop. So in addition to continuing with their table-tilting sessions, they started trying out classical cabinet mediumistic sittings, where the medium would sit in a curtained-off area, and various kinds of large-scale physical phenomena started to occur. So we had a session of each kind.
Mm-hmm.
And at the cabinet setting, there were 13 people present. At the table tilting session, there were 9 people present.
Okay. And did you witness the table tilting?
Oh yes. Well, in that case, we actually had 2 high definition infrared video camcorders, and part of that session we captured in high definition video in total darkness, and we got some very good video of the table moving dramatically. Regrettably, I mean, as a piece of evidence, it's not perfect because we had only one camera focused above the table and one focused below the table, and from the position of the overhead camera we couldn't see all the participants' hands, but I think if you look at the video with an open mind, it's clear that many of the dramatic movements we saw couldn't have been produced by the pressure or the influence of any of the people sitting around the table. We also got a complete table levitation, but the camera wasn't running at that time, and that felt completely different than the vigorous table movements we got at other times, because suddenly the table just seemed weightless, and it wasn't as if it was pushed up. It just rose up very smoothly.
And
that was cool.
Is this video available for the general public to see someplace?
Not yet, I'm afraid.
Okay.
I would have to get the permission. I'm sure you're curious. I have to get the permission
curious.
of the circle members. And I've gotten my grant renewed for investigating the Felix Group, and we're going to buy a third high-definition camcorder so we can have both with two cameras above the table and one below, and that way we can see all the hands above the table. I did show some of the video at a recent conference at the Society for Scientific Exploration, and the Felix members have some of the video, so if they decide to release it, they'll put it on their own website. That's up to them.
Mm. Yeah, I've seen many photos of the levitations, you know, with D.D. Hume and others. It seemed quite extraordinary. I mean, how much of an elevation was there? I mean, we're talking a couple of inches off the ground? Or?
Yeah, this was not the most dramatic table levitation they said they've ever gotten. They said they've had it go up quite high and stay up for quite a while. This one, I'd say, went up several inches and stayed up for several seconds. So it was quick, but it was clear that the table top was level with the floor, was parallel with the floor the whole time. And everybody responded exactly at the same time. They all went, whoa, you know, because this was quite different from what had happened.
Before the table levitated, was this a request from the members seating around the table, you know, to make the table levitate?
No, nothing specific. The table had by that time been moving very vigorously in both directions, clockwise and counterclockwise. And I think actually, if the room hadn't been so small and cozy, the table would have probably have left the room. It was bumping up against my knee all the time. I had a slight bruise afterwards.
Right. I don't know whether you'd have the same opinion as with your personal hat on versus your scientific hat on, but is your reaction that this is a clearly, you know, psychokinesis caused by the members sitting around the table, or is it possible that there could be so-called, you know, spirit involved in it?
Well, the latter is certainly possible. I'm not going to rule that out, but there's nothing that positively suggests it. It really just seems to be a case of PK by committee. It's not clear which people or how many of them were actually responsible for the result. But, I mean, that's one of those questions that, in principle, is just extremely difficult to answer.
Right. You've written books trying to answer that.
Yeah, I'm pretty frustrated.
What I'm always curious about is whether or not, clearly with many of the different projects that have been going on, like the Global Consciousness, project, and it seems that, you know, the combined effect of energy or of people thinking, throwing out the same intention seems to be more powerful than, you know, when one individual does it. But, you know, I guess at all these seances, I always question whether or not, you know, if the sitters all sat there with their arms crossed and disbelieving any psychic phenomena, I don't think anything would happen.
No doubt. And the psychodynamics of these situations are very complex. And, you know, I talked a few minutes ago about the fear of responsibility for the phenomena. One of the reasons why people have suggested for several decades now that these things happen more readily in group contexts is, first of all, because no one person has to feel responsible. It's always easy for each person to blame it on somebody else or on the group. So nobody has to feel thoroughly responsible for this.
Right.
And another thing is the general approach is to sing songs, tell jokes, keep it very light, and not worry too much about success or failure. And that way, also, I think it helps relieve the fear of responsibility for the phenomena, to approach it almost as a game.
We have a caller. Would you like to take a call?
Would you mind taking a phone
call?
Okay.
Not at all.
We have Juliet on line one.
Hello, Juliet.
Hi. I'm calling to ask a question for Dr. Brody.
I'm here.
We're on with Dr. Brody.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Well, it's fascinating, everything that you're speaking of. And I was wondering about the ectoplasm. I know, having attended a lecture by Stacey Horn where she had shown photographs of ectoplasm, it was really quite unbelievable. And when you talk about it appearing in different substance form, I wondered if anyone has ever done any kind of scientific work breaking it down for DNA or, you know, what the structure of it actually is.
It's a very good question. Generally speaking, the material gets reabsorbed back into the medium, and many mediums have actually yelled out in pain when it's been touched. So there seems to be a great deal of sensitivity involved in the production of it. It seems very fragile. It's one of the reasons the case of the Gold Leaf Lady interested me, because unlike these standard cases, I'll call them standard, where ectoplasm seems to be emanating from a medium, the golden foil didn't disappear. It lingered, so we could scrape it off the woman's body and have it analyzed. So there have been no analyses done of the actual material itself. There have been cases where it's been observed very close at hand so that the texture of the material could be described and it could be photographed near at hand, but no analyses of the sort you mentioned. That would be great if it could be done, but the Felix group in Germany is working toward that. They're working toward getting to the point where they can touch the substance.
Well, that would be fascinating to find out more about. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you for calling.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Now that you mention it, I was looking at some photos posted by the Felix group, and they were showing some material, the wax material that seemed to just appear. It was like a bar of soap.
Those they say are apports. They just seem to come out of nowhere, and they're wax balls, and when you break them open, things fall out. Objects that are meaningful to various of the participants in the group.
Wow, that's pretty interesting.
That's very cool.
It is interesting, yeah.
Yeah. But we're going to put our interests aside for a few minutes, and we're going to take a break, and then we'll be right back.
Okay, stay with us.
Okay.
Heal your loss and grief through these spiritual hypnotherapy CDs. Titles include Talking with the Dead, The Inner Healer, Meeting Your Higher Self, and A Past Life Regression and Between Life Exploration. Dr. Holly Holmes Meredith is director of HCH Institute for Hypnotherapy and Psychospiritual Trainings. Go to hypnotherapytraining.com to sample and order her CDs. These CDs will empower you in your healing and transformation.
Has your marketing pitch been missing the strike zone? Maybe you need a new player to help your marketing efforts. At LNRProductions.com, you'll find a team that can give your broadcast advertising the winning edge. LNR Productions has produced award-winning jingles, radio and television commercials for many businesses just like yours. Radio and television advertising work, but you need the right game plan. Make sure you're getting the most out of your ad every time it airs. LNRProductions.com. We'll throw strikes for your business every time.
Hello, I am Lloyd Auerbach, parapsychologist and author. You can learn much more about life after death, precognition, mind-matter interactions, remote viewing, ghost hunting, and other psychic experiences and research through the acclaimed Distance Learning Parapsychological Studies program at HCH Institute. Our courses are audio-based with additional written and video material. Call HCH at 925-283-3941 or visit www.hypnotherapytraining.com. Our courses include The Search for Life After Death, Being Psychic, Psychokinesis and Precognition, Ghost Hunting, Theories and Models of Psychic Experience, and more. Taken singly or as part of the certificate program, these courses will enrich your knowledge of parapsychology and the range of psychic phenomena. You'll learn about being psychic yourself. Visit www.hypnotherapytraining.com or call 925-283-3941 for information about our individual distance learning courses and certificate program.
For years, people have been reporting communication from those no longer in our physical world. Historically, science and religion have taught us to ignore such messages. Yet, there is now substantial scientific evidence to the contrary. In response to this, the Forever Family Foundation has developed a sign registry to demonstrate the existence of this other dimension. On our website, people can register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to a specific loved one. Upon the registrant's passing, the stored information can be verified by the recipient of these signs. Participants will be taking part not only in a grand scientific experiment, but in providing the greatest gift of all, the knowledge that we survive our physical death. For more information, contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707, or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Or to register a sign, go directly to thesignregistry.com.
If you are just tuning in, our guest here tonight is Dr. Stephen Browdy. This show is sponsored by HCH, an institute for psycho-spiritual trainings, and can be found on the web at www.hypnotherapytraining.com. And we also like to welcome HCH, an institute for psycho-spiritual training, to our growing list of Forever Family Foundation business members who enjoy a complete promotional package in all Forever Family Foundation media outlets. If you're interested in this, give us a call at 631-425-7707. And before we get back to Dr. Browdy, I have one announcement for our listeners. And I just wanted to share that with these hard times upon us, some of our supporters write to say they love the radio show, they want to see it continue, they love the work of Forever Family Foundation, but they just don't have extra dollars these days to send our way. Even though we are a 100% volunteer, not-for-profit organization, it still takes a lot of money to do the work we do, and yet we want to do so much more. So this is how everyone can help without sending us money. Go to foreverfamilyfoundation.org and apply for the Visa credit card. Visa will make a donation to us for each card that is taken out. And each time the card is used, a portion of that charge is donated back to Forever Family Foundation. But you don't have to stop there. If your shopping takes you to the Internet, consider shopping at Amazon.com, but first use the link on the Forever Family Foundation website. And again, a portion of your spending comes back to support our work. Now, if you don't see what you want on Amazon, then sign up with iGive.com and name Forever Family Foundation as the charity of your choice. Then search iGive.com for your items. For each search, we will receive a donation. And when you find your items in one of their 700-plus online stores, sites, hotels, and that list goes on, a portion of what you spend is, again, donated back to Forever Family Foundation. So please take a few moments when you shop to show us that you care. And I just want to remind everybody, if you haven't made your reservations for the Forever Family Foundation Annual Conference in Fort Myers, Florida, November 13th and 14th, you can do that. If you're a vendor in the area, we have vendor tables available. And the Holidays Past raffle is up and running, so go to the website and buy your chances.
And thank you, Fran. And we're back with our guest, Stephen Browdy. And you know, we left talking about, you know, ectoplasm a bit, and I wanted to ask you, partly because I'm so curious and partly because I trust your opinion so much. So did you, when I looked at the photos posted again by the Felix Group on their website, you clearly see, you know, some sort of cloudy substance that appears to be coming, you know, out of the medium's head or other part of the medium's body. And I don't know whether that was directly from the session you attended or prior sessions, but did you witness any ectoplasm?
Yes, and let me describe the conditions under which I observed it. I was sitting, if the medium was at 12 o'clock, I was at 3 o'clock in the group. And The room was completely dark. The medium was in the curtained off part of the room, and the group counted backwards from 15. And when we got to 5, the circle leader turned on a red light, and the medium parted the curtains. And the first thing we saw was a hand and attached to a wrist about 7 or 8 inches long coming out of his mouth. The whole thing was kind of white. I couldn't say exactly what sort of material it might have been. It didn't exactly look like a living human hand, but it certainly had the shape of a hand. And so for a few seconds, we looked at that. Then we turned the light off again. We counted backwards from 15, At 5, the light was turned on again, and this time the hand was all the way on the floor and was attached by a long, whatever you want to call it, a long wrist, I guess, coming out of the medium's mouth, but then went all the way to the floor. So we saw that for a few seconds, and then we turned off the light again, counted backwards from 15, and at 5 the light was turned on, and this time nothing was coming out of the medium's mouth, but there was a large whitish hand-like thing moving on the medium's left shoulder. And so that's as close as I got to it. In seances that occurred after that, this was the first time that had happened with the Felix group, so it was a major event. And they've been getting more of those phenomena since, and they're getting better and better photographic documentation of it. What I'm hoping is that when I go back there with my infrared high-def camcorders, they're going to let us photograph the whole thing in infrared so that we can see what kinds of controls are actually being applied. That will obviously improve the quality of the evidence. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're asking me how I evaluate that, I'll tell you that my gut reaction is to trust the medium. I've spent a lot of time with him. I have a good feeling about him. I have a good feeling about the circle leader. But I also have to say, in the spirit of full disclosure, when I think about my gut reactions, when I think about my marital history, for example, and my history of failed marriages in particular, I have to be a little wary about my gut reactions, okay? So...
Well, the...
So there we are, okay?
I hear you. Well, let me ask you this. The when we talk about... you mentioned a red light, you know, and then the light turning being turned off. Now, most of these materializations take place under very, very low light or red light, and the explanation for that, from what I've read, is that the direct light seems to affect not only the process, but it could be hurtful to the medium in some way.
Well, I mean, that certainly is a widespread belief. Whether it's true or not, I'm not so sure, because what makes some of the best cases of mediumistic phenomena as good as they are is that the phenomena occurred under decent light. So there are cases, for example, certain experiments with D.D. Hume, certain experiments with Eusebio Palladino that occurred under decent electric light. Mm. Or and other kinds of light. I mean, for example, in William Crookes' famous accordion experiment with D.D. Hume, one of the investigators was under the table where the cage with the accordion was in with a lamp. And so it was not an electric lamp, but it was presumably some sort of fuel that produced the light. But still, it was a decent light. It wasn't just a mere red light.
Right. And as I recall from that... experiment was that at some point the accordion continued to play even though that Hume was not touching it in any way.
Crookes asked Hume to take his hands out of the cage, and then he ran an electric current through the cage and the accordion was still flopping around inside.
Yeah, and those were before the days that we had these sophisticated musical instruments that can play themselves, I guess.
The hypothesis that some people put forward that Hume is concealing some sort of device on his body, I think you need to ask, all right, this is 1871. What kind of device are we talking about here?
Right. I know some of the other things that take place in some of these things. I know that in the old seances they talked about, you know, trumpets that would levitate and actually, you know, move around the room.
We had that in Germany.
You did. Okay.
Yeah, we did. There was. They had a among the various things that happened. They had a trumpet-like object made out of folded up or rolled up cardboard, it seemed.
Right.
And there was a luminescent strip attached to the large end, so that when it was charged and all the lights were off, we could see what the location of the trumpet was. So at one point, while that object was in the center of the circle, and the lights were off, we could clearly see it going up. And what was particularly interesting about it is that the trumpet moved around the circle and approached each individual sitter, not as if there was somebody standing in the middle of the room from a fixed pivot position, but as if the whatever was holding the trumpet was moving from different positions directly toward each of the sitters, and the trumpet was brought up right in front of the people's faces, but never touched one of them. Now, the room is completely dark. So, I mean, I don't think, not everybody was speaking or singing at these times, so it's not as if there were audible cues that would have given away the location of the person, so that if somebody were fraudulently carrying it around, it would have been easy to tell how close you could actually move the trumpet in darkness.
Yeah. Well, I guess those are the two things as an observer that you would, well, as an untrained observer, I mean, the two things I would be looking at is, one, is it possible that it's tied to some sort of string that people are manipulating, or that, as you say, somebody's moving it around, but clearly it didn't seem to be the case, that at least under your observation, right?
I think it's hard to sustain that kind of hypothesis, but obviously it would have been nice if we could have been video recording the whole thing in infrared. So I still have hopes for going back and doing that sort of stuff. And I have to commend the people in charge of the Felix group, unlike lots of spiritualist groups where they don't show any interest in trying to help researchers obtain really good documentation of the phenomena. The medium and the circle leader are very interested in doing so.
You know, Whitten, I had read about the Bindelhof group from years ago. I think we had Dr. Pilkington on the show a few months ago. And reading some of those accounts, the thing that was most fascinating to me was when the group members would hear, you know, a pen or a pencil being picked up and hear it, you know, writing specific messages, you know, while the group was in session. And, you know, it's just so hard for me to go totally on the PK explanation, you know, when the, you know, the thought that even a member of the group could manifest this writing, you know, with specific messages, to me is almost more unbelievable than, you know, a spirit entity making it happen. So, you know, I don't know how you feel about
that. Can I say something about that?
Yeah.
I understand that line of reasoning, and I think it's plausible, but I have a problem with it. And the problem is that if you're supposing a spirit is doing it, that's PK. But the only difference between that kind of PK and some living person doing it is whether the agent behind it all is alive or not.
Right.
And so it's PK one way or the other. And so I don't see why one kind of PK is inherently more incredible than the other. If a deceased person can do this using just the power of the deceased person's mind, why then isn't it equally plausible that a living mind could do it?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. We were talking at the top of the show a little bit about that. You know, people ask, well, why we're so interested in telepathy? Well, you know, a lot of people, I mean, I think of spirit communication as telepathy. It's just that one person doesn't have a body, you know, so...
That's exactly right.
Yeah, so it's certainly, all these things need investigation. And, you know, the hope is that, I'm sure the hope of you and many of your colleagues is that all of these disciplines are going to come together with certain common threads that are isolated that will give us greater insight into all these phenomena that we call paranormal.
Well, I would like that. I'm becoming more chronologically challenged all the time, and I'll be retiring this summer, so I'd like to get some answers before it's too late.
I know. Well, we're relying on you. We're counting on you. You know, you better just get a few more grants before you go. And, you know... I always thought that personal experience, you know, trumps empirical data, you know, so you may or may not trust the data. You know, you could read a lot about, you could hear anecdotal reports from other people, but when you have a direct experience, whether it be, you know, near-death experience or a mediumship type of occurrence, you know, on a personal level, it takes on deeper meaning. I mean, would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. Unfortunately, not everybody is lucky enough to be initiated in that way, and so it always remains a live question for those who haven't had the personal experiences. How can they, if they're open-minded about this, how can they reach some sort of conclusion about what to think? And this is
from reading The Gold Leaf Lady, I mean, on a personal level, you may have read a bit about
astrology, and you may have been on the fence about it, and then you had this direct personal experience of your wife Gina using this astrological data to accurately predict the future, and that to you must have put you in a different mindset, so to speak, than you were before.
Yes, it freaked me out.
Yeah.
It really does.
I was trying to say that in a different way, but it didn't
no,
freak you out.
No, I had my prejudices, and this was just another one of those humbling. This was another one of those humbling life experiences.
Yeah. Well, if you do retire to Las Vegas, that may come in handy. So.
Yeah. Well, that is part of the hope, actually. I guess I shouldn't have mentioned that.
I'll be. I may be more interested in following you along with that than the science, so we'll see.
Okay. We'll be
we hear all this talk about, not more than talk, I mean, the books and volumes written from channeling and automatic writing. You know, and automatic writing was always fascinating to me because there are some of the information is so, you know, deep and significant. But there were always those questions, you know, most of the people that are doing the channeling or the automatic writing are smart, spiritual people and insightful. And, you know, how can we really tell for sure whether it's, you know, it's coming from the mind of the channeler versus, you know, a spirit entity? I guess that's a challenge for all scientists, I would imagine.
It is. It's one of the big questions. And I think, you know, if you're approaching no satisfactory way to answer it. It's the kind of thing that we may have to actually wait until we die to get some handle on.
Right, and the trick is to let the rest of us know when that happens.
That's the big trick, indeed.
Yeah. Well, we've set up quite a number of experiments that way. I hope unfortunately, that may be the only time that we have, you know, true answers. I'm not even sure. You know, I mean, people think that When we pass on and our consciousness survives, that we're automatically given this gift of endless knowledge and of the universe, and you know we may very well be on a learning curve the same way that we are here.
Right, and for all we know, it may be that some people are more impaired after the transition than they were before. I mean,
right.
I think it. There are any number of possible scenarios, and I don't think any one of them is inherently more plausible than another.
Well, we have been talking with Stephen Browdy. Dr. Browdy's website is www.jazzphilosopher.com. That'll also give you the link to his University of Maryland website, which has, you know, more information on it. As we mentioned before, Dr. Browdy is the author of 5 books, and just about everything that you want to know that's psi-related can be, the information could be gleaned from these books. We have links to all of them on our website, Amazon links, if you go to foreverfamilyfoundation.org. And we thank you so much for being with us. I know we just touched a little bit of, there was a lot more to talk about, but we always love you having come on as a guest, and I hope you'll consider coming on again.
Absolutely. It's fun for me every time. Thank you very much.
Right. Well, thanks, and we'll be talking with you soon.
Okay. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was wonderful. And just before we say goodnight, I'd like to read the prayer for the Gulf. Now let's give energy of love and gratitude to the waters and all the living creatures in Mexico Gulf by praying like this. To the waters, whales, dolphins, pelicans, fishes, shellfishes, planktons, corals, algae, and all creatures in our Gulf of Mexico, I apologize. Please forgive me. Thank you. I love you. And that was first written by Masaru Emoto on May 9th, 2010. And with that, we'd like to
tell you that our loved ones are only a heartbeat away.
And science is going to prove it.
Good night, everyone.